The title of today's message is Wisdom for My Neighbors. Or you may choose the alternate title, Loving Your Neighbor as Yourself, Part 2. The message actually is Part 2 of a two-part series, and I admit that it's unusual to give Part 2 of a sermon before Part 1, but that's just how it worked out. There are at least 8 times in the Bible where we are instructed to love our neighbors as ourselves. Starts in Leviticus and goes all and then in numerous cases from Christ and the apostles in the New Testament all the way through James. And so I got to thinking about my neighbors. In the pioneering farming community where I grew up, my great-grandfather was a homesteading pioneer, as was his father and his father's brothers. And his family, and the whole neighborhood of farm families had known each other by the time I came along for 2 or 3 generations. And of course, loving your neighbor as yourself, I got to thinking when I was reviewing that subject about my neighbors, that what could I learn from them? After all, they weren't all exactly lovable, but if I was to love my neighbors, I would have to know something about them. I would have to understand them. I would have to glean what wisdom I could from them. And so I'm going to take a look at what wisdom I could glean from those neighbors. I'm going to review 12 biblical lessons that I learned from my neighbors, lessons that were demonstrated by these examples from everyday life. One of the fellows, and I'll have to adjust their names because whether they're not alive, but their offspring may be, is a fellow we'll call Big Eddie. Now, there's a reason they called him Big Eddie, because he was the biggest guy in the neighborhood, and that was just understood. And he was very affectionate about being called Big Eddie. And Big Eddie was often at everyone's household in the neighborhood from time to time, because he was a custom farm operator. He worked, had specialized equipment and harvesting equipment, and would go from farm to farm and assist with harvesting with his specialized equipment. And it was customary that you would feed your visiting worker a meal. And so we would sit and eat meals, and he would tell us the stories of his youth and life in the history of the neighborhood. Big Eddie told the story of when he was a young man, and all of the neighbors at that time, in fact, even while I was growing up, they all cooperated with each other during harvest season, because no man could efficiently do all of the work alone, so people worked cooperatively. There was an occasion, it was about in the 1930s, when the neighbor farmers had all gathered together and were working as a group to harvest the fields, and day after day, the farmers in the morning would do their own chores. And then they would gather at a different farm that day for harvest until that particular farm was harvested. Then they would move on to the next one and making it around the neighborhood until harvesting would complete. Everybody donated their time, knowing that when the time came, everybody would also be at their house. Big Eddie told the story of one day that two men had a disagreement. One of the men insisted on carrying out the argument, but the other fellow refused to argue. Yet the more contentious man pursued the matter, intent on provoking a fight. The fellow who refused to argue or fight simply put down his tools, and he walked home about a mile away. This was not lost on Big Eddie, who was a young man. The next day, both farmers showed up for the cooperative harvest crew, and the issue was diffused. They had gone home, slept overnight. Things looked differently the next day, and cooler heads prevail. In Proverbs 15, verse 1, in the King James Version, in Proverbs 15, verse 1, there's a principle that I'm sure we've heard before, maybe seen it practiced by others, or practiced ourselves. A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. I looked at that verse, Proverbs 15:1, in the Complete Jewish Bible, and it puts it a little more smoothly. A gentle response deflects fury, but a harsh word makes tempers rise. Well, there was an opportunity there for if the second man would have stepped into the and took the taunts or the teasing or the arguing, whatever the cross words were between them, but he refused to do so. His method of soft word was to simply bow out of the fight. He was not going to be engaged or involved. In the contemporary English version, the Bible of the Bible in Proverbs 15:1, it says, "A kind answer soothes angry feelings, but harsh words stir them up." And so this second fellow didn't stir up the matter with harsh words. In fact, he just stepped out of the matter altogether. So the lesson number one, a soft answer turns away wrath. There are time or occasions when we will be prodded or stirred, and it would be the wise thing to do to simply provide a soft answer or no answer at all, but certainly avoid the harsh answer. Now, Big Eddie, of course, was a custom farmer, and this means he had that equipment that took him from farm to farm, and he came to our farm. My dad hired him each September to bring his equipment to chop corn silage that could used to fill our silos and feed the livestock. The corn was chopped in the field with the equipment, and then it was hauled in wagons to the farmstead. And a machine called a blower, it was actually a heavy-duty fan run by a tractor power takeoff, it blew the chopped corn up into a tall upright silo, which was a cement storage bin. And there the chopped corn would ferment. So it took a lot of chopping and a lot of hauling and a lot of wagons to haul large wagons, very large wagons. You would think it's like a tractor pulling a recreational vehicle of some sort, you know, just large wagons of chopped silage home from the fields. And when my brothers and I were teenagers, we drove the tractors with those silage wagons to and from the cornfield. And one day during silo filling, my dad was driving a tractor that was pulling a silage wagon on the bumpy field road. And the field road was bumpy such that the hitch pin, or the hitch on the tractor, caused the hitch pin to pop out. The tractor and the wagon box was empty. He was on his way back to the field, which is why it was a little more bouncy than usual. If it was a full wagon box, everything would have been a full load. It would have been a little tighter. But the hitch pin popped out. The tractor and the wagon were on a slight downgrade. And so as a result, the wagon started picking up speed to bump into the tractor. The wheels of the tractor going round and round, my father was sitting on the tractor, realized in an instant that if that wagon came up and caught the wheels of the tractor, it would ride up those wheels and it would crush him. Well, he had a very quick decision to make. And I'm not sure how he managed to make such a quick decision. But he jumped forward at an angle off of the tractor. From up in the air, took a wild leap, jumping forward in a matter of seconds, and managed to get off to the side of the tractor. And the wagon box, indeed, climbed up the tires and slamming forward, and it caught the back of the tractor seat, and it pressed it up tight against the steering wheel. Had he remained in the seat, he would have been crushed. Those of us that weren't right there were there right afterwards to see it, to see that this big wagon was on top of a tractor, the seat crushed up against the steering wheel, and that was the only visible damage, was the tractor seat was bent. At that point, we all knew that silo filling for that part of the day was over with. We had some work to do to get the wagon down from on top of the tractor, some repairs to make, to put everything back in order. And so we stopped the silo filling process and used tractors and loaders and get the wagon down. And not much work was made that morning, and it was in the morning. And one of the men went to town to the farm supply store and bought safety pins for all of the tractors. Now, of course, I've mentioned it's custom on the farm that the host farm would serve the lunch to the work crew. And so Big Eddie held a meeting with all the men, and us boys, and said he recommended that everyone say absolutely nothing to my mother or anybody else about this near-death accident that had just occurred. There was a lot of silo filling to do yet that day on that farm and on a lot of other farms, and that would induce panic among many. Everyone was sobered by the thought it could have been them on the tractor, and they might not have reacted as quickly as my father did. Well, to my knowledge, about 45 years have passed, and my mother still hasn't heard about the day that she nearly became a widow. Big Eddie didn't want to cause distress in the family or among the neighbors, and the silos all still had to be filled, harvest still had to go on. And we fixed the machinery, took action to prevent the problem, and we kept our mouths shut. To say anything at that point would not have served any good purpose. Let's look at Proverbs 17 and verse 9. In Proverbs 17, verse 9. Now, of course, the wise thing to would have been to prevent the problem, because if you prevent the problem, it solves a lot of issues. In Proverbs 17:9, he who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. In other words, that this was a good time to simply let it go. We fixed the problem. Nobody was hurt. It was minimal expense. It cost a little bit of time, and it would have not. And the future problems were prevented in that everybody was buying hitch pins, safety pins, and everybody was sobered by the thought. So lesson number two, do not miss an opportunity to keep our mouths shut. Sometimes the best thing said is nothing at all. So Big Eddie taught two lessons from my neighbors that helped us to make good long-term decisions. Then there was the neighbor Cliff. Cliff was a city guy who grew up on the farm. But he always had a dream, and he didn't grow up in our neighborhood, but he always had a dream that he could return to the farm one day. And he did. He managed to purchase a small farm next to our family farm, and he moved his family of five kids from the nearby town out to the farm. The problem was that Cliff really didn't know how to be a farmer. He had a traveling sales job, and so he was gone a lot. He rented some of his land to our family. And he tried to raise livestock, baby calves, feeder steers, but he didn't really have the machinery or the know-how to do the job. So he often came over to talk to my dad, who was about his age, to get advice about what to do and how to do it. I remember one day in the spring, he came out to the field during soybean planting time, and he was wearing his city dress clothes with his low-top dress shoes. And he walked through the loose, moist soil in the field, where my dad was on the tractor planting soybeans, and he tiptoed out there through the dirt, and he asked a simple question, well, how deep do you plant soybeans? Well, all farmers know that you plant the soybeans as shallow as possible. If you're planting beans, just so you have a little bit of soil to cover it is all you need, because beans sprout very quickly, and that was the problem. My dad was dumbfounded that the man, you know, would know this. And so my dad, in his usual good humor, said, you plant them about an inch above the ground, maintaining a straight face. And to his surprise, Cliff said, oh, okay. And he kind of went on home, and that was the instruction. He was going to plant them an inch above the ground, which, of course, meant very, very shallow. That's good old Cliff said, uh-huh. Well, regular farmers, of course, they all understood that Cliff needed a little help. Cliff was always borrowing machinery from his neighbors, and all of his neighbors were generous. But Cliff was careful not to borrow a machine from any one neighbor very often. And so he would borrow one from one fellow and then another one from another, and he would make the rounds. And it was only at neighborhood get-togethers, such as at a 4-H club picnic or a farm auction or other event, that the neighbors would get to chatting, and they discovered that Cliff was farming using everybody else's machinery. He really had little himself. Now, of course, all the farmers knew what Cliff was desperately trying to be a farmer and hanging on to his hope and dream of being a farmer. And the neighbor farmers all rather chuckled. They didn't mind working with Cliff because They all shared the same hopes and the same dreams to live their lifestyle in peace and harmony, each one of them wanting to pursue their dream. Well, Cliff was pursuing his dream and his hope and doing the best that he could. And let's turn to Psalm 71 and verse 5. In Psalm 71 and verse 5. What about our dreams? What about our hopes? Are we pursuing our dreams and our hopes? If so, where is our hope? In Psalm 71, verse 5, I'm going to quote it from the Amplified Bible. For you are my hope, O Lord God. You are my trust from youth and the source of my confidence. In other words, we look to God for our hope. That's where we place our trust. That's where we place our confidence. When we follow our dreams, that's the confidence that we need to have. So lesson from Cliff is to live your dream. Lesson three from Cliff, live your dreams, but place your hope and confidence in God. And then there were the brothers Ralph and Ray. Ralph and Ray were noted for thinking big. They thought big all the time. They built, they farmed a lot of land. They built the biggest silo I have ever seen. It was one of those that was the size of this room and maybe 80 feet tall. It was just humongous. And we wondered, where are they going to get all of the crop to put in there? But they had a lot of land. And they just, it was astounding. And they worked all the time. Ray had five kids, but somehow still found time to serve on the school board. Unfortunately, he died and left a widow and five children under age 17 as of a farm accident. But Ray left his mark because he thought big and he worked hard. His brother Ralph lived on. His brother Ralph also thought big. And he found a piece of ground that was undeveloped. I mean, it was just, you know, marginal land. It was a lot of swampy edges to it. It wasn't a complete field. It was a quarter section, 160 acres. And Ralph said, you know, this land is I can buy it for very little, but how am I, and I, can I make it productive? And he did something that nobody else in the area was doing. He followed the example of the Dutch from the Netherlands, and he drained it by pumping it out and made it all one big field, something that nobody had ever done or thought of in that area, and put underground drainage tile, drained it into a big pit, and pumped it over a dike, just as they do in the low countries in the Netherlands. For them, what everybody said was impossible for Ralph and Ray, but the seemingly impossible was actually possible, but for them it just took a little longer. But just because somebody said it couldn't be done didn't stop them, because they just went ahead and did it. Let's turn to Proverbs 29 and verse 18. You see, they had a vision. They looked ahead to what they wanted to accomplish. And then they worked at that vision. They worked at that dream to make that happen. In Proverbs 29:18, I have it in the King James Version. Where there is no vision, the people perish, but he that keeps the law, happy is he. In other words, there's a vision, there's a hope, there's an opportunity, but these fellows envisioned their future. How do we envision our future? Do we have a vision of what God has in store for us? Do we have our eyes that we keep on the prize? Do we think of the pearl of great price, the knowledge of God to accomplish the vision that God has set before us? So lesson four is, have a vision of the future. Think big beyond ourselves. Keep our eye on the prize so that we may accomplish the vision that God has set before us. One of the most interesting fellows in the neighborhood where I grew up was Walt. Walt lived simply all the time. Walt had no phone, no electricity, no wife or children either. He did have one luxury. He used a gasoline motor to pump water from his hand-dug well. He had one cow. I provided him milk for which he could make the butter. When I knew Walt, he was an old man who had rented out his farm on shares, meaning that the tenant or his tenant would give him a share of the crop in return for payment in the rent. So he didn't take it in cash. He could do with it what he will. He had the crop. He could sell it. He could feed it to his few livestock. When I knew him, he was an old man, and I was helping out a neighbor, and I came over and helped, and I unloaded hay bales for him in his barn. He didn't use the hay barn anymore overhead. It was too hard for him to get up to it. So we just carried a load of about 100 bales, individually carrying, like hugging a bale, walking in the door, and putting it in various places in the barn. And he would show us exactly where to put each bale, in what position, so that it was easy for him, because he had difficulty getting around as an older fellow, where, how to put that, because he would be needing it in the winter to feed his cow that he had on his little farm. He burned wood to keep warm in the winter, and he also got free rubber tires, and he burned those in his stove, so you can imagine his house was a little black and sooty. And so, but one winter, old Walt got sick, and he couldn't keep his fire warm, because he couldn't tend the fire, and it got cold in his house. When one of the neighbors went to check on Walt, they found that he was sick and that the house was cold and that Walt had frozen his toes. So they hauled him off to the hospital. And while he was at the hospital, Walt asked the neighbor to send two particular neighbors over to see him. And he called those two neighbors in together. He wanted them to come in together. And he trusted the two of them together. Not one of them, but two of them. And he told them where he had hidden the money. He had secreted money on his farm, and he had hoarded it all his life. He didn't have banks. He didn't trust banks. He had been through the Depression. He didn't trust them. But old Walt paid cash for everything. He paid cash for his hospitalization. He always paid his taxes. But old Walt couldn't take care of himself anymore. He couldn't go home. He paid cash for his nursing home for the years until his death. In 2 Thessalonians 3:11, one thing we can say in the times that I was visited Walt and helping out over the years, in 2 Thessalonians 3:11, is that Walt never had anything negative to say about anybody. Now, you could say that that's because he didn't have a telephone or he didn't spend any money to go anywhere. But Walt paid attention to his own business. In 2 Thessalonians 3:11, where the Apostle Paul is writing to those in Thessalonica, For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. Now, you couldn't say that about Walt. He was always working until the bitter end where he no longer could function at all. And he wasn't a busybody. It didn't bother him if other people were doing things, whether they should or they shouldn't. That wasn't his business. He didn't involve himself in it. In 1 Timothy 5:13, we talk about these same kind of people. Paul is writing to his helper Timothy in 1 Timothy 5:13. And withal they learn to be idle, wandering from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. Couldn't say that about Walt. He wasn't going around. He was busy paying attention, working by himself, and honoring those that helped him. 1 Peter 4:15. It's interesting what the apostles say about this same subject in 1 Peter 4:15. But let none of you suffer as a murderer. Ooh, well, that's pretty bad. Or as a thief. That, we think of that as pretty bad. Or as an evildoer. Nobody wants to be called an evildoer. Or as a busybody in other men's matters. Nobody could. That's pretty serious when you're putting it all together. But nobody could accuse Walt of being busy in anyone else's business, because Walt took care of Walt and was a very responsible citizen in his way. Nobody could say that Walt was disorderly or that he was idle or that he was worked and busied himself in the affairs of others. He didn't live beyond his means. He minded his own business. Lesson 5 is, live simply and tend to your own affairs and not as a busybody in other people's lives. The more I looked around the neighborhood and I thought about these fellows, there was always something that I could extract from each of them that I never really thought about before, until you focus on those people that have affected your lives in some way. There was the neighbor, Art. Art worked hard all the time. Now, Art didn't bathe often. I know he bathed at least annually because there was a local parade, and I know he always took a bath before the parade when he went into town to enjoy that. But Art had a very generous heart. His honesty was never in doubt. He was always ready to help anyone at any time. He woke up very early, before 5 every morning. I know, because I worked with Art for one summer in the mid-70s. Art did custom grain swathing. His father-in-law was Big Eddie. So he also did some custom work, and he had 2 grain swathers. Well, grain swathing is where you cut grain and you put it in a row before it's ready to harvest, and then it's placed in rows to dry. And then a harvesting machine called a combine comes along and it threshes the grain and separates the grain from the straw and the chaff. Well, I ran one of his 2 swathers. So I was working for Art one summer as a young man. And one morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, an axle broke on the swather that Art was driving. Everyone thought that we'd be out of business right at the peak of harvest season, because it would take about 2 weeks to get a replacement axle. The factory was in Pennsylvania, and poor Art, who was generally easygoing, was highly stressed, just always relaxed, and he wasn't really up. You couldn't see anything upset, but you knew it was churning inside. And because he was concerned he would be letting down all of his customers, because they relied on him. He was the only one with swathers in the neighborhood, and we did all the swathing, and it just had to be done. So I got on the telephone, and being the young whippersnapper that I was, I got on the phone and I arranged for air freight a replacement part from the factory in Pennsylvania to the Minnesota, where I picked the part up the next day at the airport in the Twin Cities, and we lost about a day and a half of precious time during that grain harvest season. But one thing you could say with Art is that he never really stopped working. Now, he should have stopped from time to time, at least to take a bath, you know, and socialize a little bit more, perhaps. But Art was, and nobody accused him of having the biggest intellect in the world, but Art was a hard worker. He was an honest man and a hard worker. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes 9:10. In Ecclesiastes 9:10, Art followed this advice, whether he ever read this verse or not. Ecclesiastes 9:10, whatever you are capable of doing, do with all your might, because there's no work, thought, knowledge, or wisdom in the grave, which is where you are headed. That's the English Common Bible translation. I thought I had rolled the smoothest off the tongue. In other words, the lesson from Art, and having worked with him for that year, lesson 6, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Then there was the neighbor, Ed. Ed diligently followed the law all the time. The Township Government Board Chairman is what Ed was. He was for many years. He took care of the rural roads and road signs. He was a very particular and methodical about everything, and especially about his public service. Being a local government official, a township official, was an unpaid job. Ed was well thought of by all of his neighbors, and everybody respected his steady hand on local government. Well, Ed was a bit of a heavyset fellow, and as an older fellow, we purchased a riding lawnmower where the engine was behind the mower seat. It was an old-style lawnmower that had to be started using a pull rope. And Ed pulled the rope and the engine started. Unfortunately, he had left the mower in a forward gear before he had shut off the engine the last time he ran it. And so when the engine started, the lawnmower started going forward because it was in gear. Well, old Ed, he kind of ran along, and he threw one leg over the lawnmower and hopped onto the lawnmower seat. But unfortunately for Ed, he misjudged the speed of the lawnmower. And he threw his leg over the lawnmower, but the lawnmower kept on moving, and he landed with a hard thud right behind the lawnmower seat. Unfortunately, he landed on top of the spark plug. 2,000 volts of electricity on a pointed spark plug tore open old Ed's bottom side and left him bleeding in agony on the ground, where he was hauled off to the hospital and received 16 or 17 stitches, and he was had a liquid diet for the next month or 6 weeks. Very unpleasant thought. Well, as you can imagine this terrible circumstance, as that word got around in the neighborhood, everybody just shivered at the terrible thought. But farming must go on. And Ed was unable to do his own farm work. So all of the neighbors went over to his farm, and as soon as they had their farm work done, they all collected. And I was there. I recall that day when all the farmers gathered together, and they harvested and plowed his farm in one day. There were tractors, trucks, and other harvest equipment. In Genesis 26, verse 4. You see, Ed was respected because his common refrain was, "It's the law." He would always be sure to find out what the law was. We're not talking the biblical law. We were talking about local law, governmental law. But he was very meticulous to follow the law because he wanted to be orderly. He wanted everything to work out right. He wanted to be fair to everyone. And so Ed was known for following the law. In Genesis 26, verse 4, "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and your seed, all nations of the earth, shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." It's a New King James. This is the blessing, the inheritance that Abraham was promised. And why was he promised that? Because he was faithful. Abraham was sort of like old Ed. He always was diligent to keep the law. And in Abraham's case, God's not just the commandments, but the statutes, all the laws that God had given to him. In John 14:15, it's a very short verse. We can turn right on to verse 21 after that. If Christ said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." In verse 21, "He who has my commandments and keeps them is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." So the loving God is keeping his commandments. Old Ed loved his farm, he loved his family, and he loved taking care of township government and keeping everything orderly. You couldn't say that he didn't. He had a real dedication and a faithfulness. God expects that same kind of faithfulness and that dedication from us. In John 15:10, "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." So Christ said that that is a measure of love as to how well you keep the Father's commandments. So the lesson from Ed, lesson 7, is diligently follow the law all of the time. Then there's a name here I'm going to change to protect the guilty. So I'll mark my notes accordingly. We'll call him Sam. In the pioneer farming neighborhood where I grew up, there was a local creamery about every 6 miles or so. When the pioneers came out that way, they had a local creamery about every 6 miles. So that far, they would have to take their horse and wagon or ox and they would only have to go 3 miles at most to take their milk to the local creamery. And the local creamery was where the cream was separated from the milk, and the milk, and then the cream was turned into butter, and the butter was shipped off to the city. And the local creamery operator then expected all the farmers, when they brought their milk, to bring clean milk to the creamery. Well, everybody had 10-gallon milk cans. I'm sure you've seen them. They're used for decoration now and not for dairy anymore. Well, the farmers brought their full milk cans to the creamery, and they dumped out the milk, and then there was a steaming hot water that cleaned the milk cans, and then the farmers returned home with clean cans. Well, Sam had a reputation for bringing dirty milk. There was straw floating in it once in a while, maybe a little hay, just little bits floating on it. And the creamery operator was a little suspicious. He was always careful. They always filtered all the milk. They were spinning out the butter and spinning out the butter fat, but you wanted clean milk. And so one day the creamery operator was pouring out a 10-gallon milk can from Sam's farm, and an overshoe came flopping out of the milk can. Well, from that point on, the creamery operator wouldn't take Sam's milk unless Sam would first drink a glass of it. Well, the first week, or the first time Sam was there, he wouldn't drink a glass of his own milk, so the creamery operator wouldn't take it. Figured if Sam didn't trust his own milk, the creamery operator sure wasn't going to trust it. Well, it wasn't long before Sam cleaned up his act, and he was bringing clean milk to the creamery. But Sam's reputation was set. He had tried to get by with selling dirty milk, and everybody knew it. As an older teen, or as a teenager, I had some horses, and I had raised a young horse, and I had a 2-year-old horse that had not yet been gelded, a male horse. So you consider the horse to be a young stallion. And one day, Sam, about a mile away, asked me if my young stallion had reached maturity. Well, I told him I didn't know. It was only 2 years old. I didn't know if a 2-year-old young stallion was old enough to reproduce. Well, I didn't think a thing of it at the time, but it wasn't long after that. Almost every day for a week, somehow Sam's little Shetland mare got out of his corral every day for the next week and made it a mile down the road to my place or our place on the farm, just neighing over the pasture. Now, day after day, we'd call up Sam and say, "It's time, your little mare is over here. It's time to come and take her home." Now, he could have simply asked, "Can I turn my pony in with your young stallion?" But he didn't. He just sent it down the road, hoping that nature would take its way. And day after day, time after time, we'd all get a chuckle and say, "Well, we kind of know what's going on there." In Psalm 32, verse 2, you see, Sam would do whatever he thought he could get away with. In Psalm 32, verse 2, "Blessed is the man whom the Lord counts no iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit." I believe in the King James Version they use the word guile, and where there is no guile. That's the English Standard Version that I read. In other words, God expects us to clean up our act and not be deceitful or have guile. And that's why the psalmist said, "Blessed is that man against whom the eternal counts no iniquity." In other words, where your sins have been wiped out. And as Sam learned in Proverbs 22, verse 1, "A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold." Now, in his defense, Sam was noted as the fellow in the neighborhood, not just for the fellow noted for trying to get away with things, but he was also the one that had the quickest conscience in the neighborhood. He was always sorry. He would come over a day later when he thought he had offended or done something wrong, and he would apologize. He would blubber over himself and say, "I'm really sorry." And so he had that redeeming quality about him that even though he tried to get away with something and it just didn't seem to work out, it just didn't seem to pan out, that little tricky whatever it was that he was doing, And then his conscience would bother him, and he'd come over, and it didn't matter which neighbor it was. He had a reputation of having a conscience, and he would go and apologize regularly. And, of course, the mumblers would say, well, if he didn't do it in the first place, he wouldn't need to apologize so much. Which is, of course, the story of life for all of us. But the lesson number 8 is, avoid guile and preserve your good name. Avoid guile and preserve your good name. Then there was Leo. Our neighbor Leo. Now, Leo was an unusual fellow. Well, they're all unusual fellows, I guess. Surely I was the only normal one among them, right? And Leo had 13 children, and all of the children's names started with the letter J. Not everybody got along with Leo, but our family always seemed to get along with his family. And as a young man, when I started farming, I rented land from Leo. And Leo was just, he was always good to me. He would give you the shirt off his back if he thought it would help you. And I found him easy to work with, but then I was okay with his bluster. He was the first person in the neighborhood with a four-wheel drive pickup truck and a gooseneck livestock trailer, so he would haul livestock for people, and he hauled cattle for my dad. He was a bold fellow who was always ready for action. And there's one thing that everyone could count on. Leo was never speechless. He had a response for everything. Didn't matter what it was. Leo was never short of an opinion. In fact, he had several on any one subject. And he was vigorous about it. And he was convinced in his own mind. Let's turn to 1 Peter 3:15. At 1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense or an answer to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. God expects us to be ready also to give an answer. Whenever it's expected of us, whenever it's necessary, to be prepared to defend what is the reason of the hope. What does God expect of us? Are we prepared when, if we are challenged or asked to respond? And so the lesson we can learn from Leo, lesson 9, is be ready always for the answer of the hope that lies within you. The next neighbor was Ernie. Now, Ernie fought in World War II under General Patton. And Ernie was engaged before he was drafted and hauled off to war. He was engaged to my dad's cousin. My dad and his cousin's parents were brother and sister, and they lived next door to each other in the next farm. So our farms were right next door. Or, you know, we shared the line fence. And during the war, there were times, as Ernie later told us, he never took his shoes off for 3 weeks. The war was so hard, with Patton coming up through Italy and into Germany. But because he grew up in a German neighborhood, he could speak German, and he was the company interpreter when they made it to Germany, when they conquered when they were marching through Germany. When he got home, from the war, he married my dad's cousin that he had waited over 4 years. And so, just like many other families, everything was put on hold. Life was put on hold. And then they started their family a little later in life than perhaps some did. But they also had a family of 4 boys, just like ours. So, as you can imagine, we had softball games in the pasture. We had football games. We had basketball in the haymow in the wintertime. And we knew each other fairly well because we were relatives. We were second cousins, but we were closer than most cousins because we were so close, both physically, and went to the same family reunions and such. One day we were playing football in the pasture over at Ernie's place, and they had dairy cows, just like all of the neighbors had. We all had dairy cows. And a cow had bumped an electric fence. It was a smooth wire fence. And it bumped the electric wire, or knocked the electric wire down, so that the wire fell on the ground. And if left that way, the cattle would all get out and roam around the neighborhood, maybe get lost in the cornfield. And so it was important to fix the fence right away. Well, Ernie was out watching the boys play football. We had lots of, almost every family had lots of boys, so we had a lot of boys out there playing football. And I said, well, I suppose somebody has to run back to the farm place and pull the plug on the electric fencer. Because you have to unplug the electric fencer in order to repair the electric fence. And Ernie looked up and said, what for? Well, I didn't understand what he meant. And Ernie picked up the electric wires with his bare hands, and I saw his hands jumping as he fixed the wire by fixing it as... I was in shock. I didn't even know it could be done. I was just fearful. If you touched a wire, you know, that was just a bad day. You know, that was a very memorable circumstance. I remember my sweet daughter Kara when she was about 6 years old on the farm, and she was wearing sneakers. And there was a smooth electric wire going around the calf pasture. But at 6 years old, you don't always have the best sense to not touch these things. And she grabbed a hold of the electric wire. And, you know, by the time you want to stop them, it's too late. They've already done it. You know, she grabbed the hold. She let go in a hurry. And then she immediately sat down. She didn't cry. She immediately sat down and started taking her shoe off. And I said, Kara, what are you doing? And she says, my foot is bleeding. Well, the electricity had gone through. And had gone to, you know, gone through to her foot, and it had arced, you know, because of the insulation by the tennis shoe, and there must have been moisture there, and it arced through. So she had gotten quite a shock, but that was pretty severe, you know, at any age. So when I watched Ernie fix the fence without bothering to turn it off, you can imagine the awe that I had that he was doing the impossible, the irrational. We were young teens at the time, and we all looked at each other, and we knew that he had fought under General Patton. And there was kind of an unspoken understanding that there wasn't any kids in the neighborhood that were going to mess with Ernie. It just wasn't worth it. He was just way too tough. Just the whole thought of it was just way too tough. Let's turn to Matthew 19 and verse 26. In Matthew 19 and verse 26, and I'm going to pull out the concept here that there are things, you know, that Ernie did that I didn't think was possible. In Matthew 19:26, when Jesus Christ beheld them, he said to them, with men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. How many things do we think that are impossible? I thought fixing an electric fence while it was on was impossible. Clearly I was wrong. Now, will I want to do that? No. Am I going to do that? No. But it helped shatter the mindset that I had, the limits that I had set a limit. It had never even occurred to me that it was possible, that it could be done. Jesus Christ said there are things that men see that are not possible, but with God all things are possible. Turn to Mark 9 and verse 23. And again, Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believes. So if we're a believer, Jesus Christ has acknowledged to us, not once, and as we'll see, not just twice, but repeatedly, all things are possible to him that believes. Now, there are things that I find more difficult than fixing an electric wire or fence while the electricity is on. I can't believe that it's possible. In other words, there are things in life that I just don't see how there's a resolution. And maybe you can see it in your life too, where you wonder, I don't see how it can ever happen. It's just, there's no way. And yet, for a believer, all things are possible to him that believe. In Mark 10, and just in the next chapter, Mark 10:27, it's repeated. The same thing. With men it is impossible, but not with God, for with God all things are possible. So if we simply rely on man's thinking, on our own selves, instead of relying on God, well, then it may be impossible. But with God, all things are possible. It's repeated again in Mark 14 and verse 16. So lesson 10, lessons from Ernie, all things are possible with God. Then there's the neighbor George. George was a one-armed farmer, rather unusual, for a one-armed farmer to be a farmer, but he had lost it early in life. He farmed with horses, and later with a tractor, but his early life was with horses. And despite his handicap, of course, it would have been difficult taking care of horses, putting on the harness and such. But he was an active and busy farmer, and one day he got into a dispute with one of his neighbors, and heated words were exchanged. He didn't go home like Big Eddie suggested, and the heated words are exchanged, and George loudly promised in front of witnesses that one day when his neighbor died, he would dig his grave an extra foot deep, just to add the insult. Now, I'm going to guess that the neighbor was a little older than he was. So he was kind of just really putting the verbal knife to him. And then life and chance would have it many years later, about 30 years later, because my dad was a young man when this happened, George's neighbor indeed died first. My dad was a young fellow at the time, and he was called upon to help dig the grave at the local cemetery. It was January in Minnesota. Each of the men brought a pick and a shovel, and of course, because it was January and because it was Minnesota, the ground was frozen. So the men took turns swinging a pick and managed to chip out a frozen piece of soil about the size of a quarter with each swing, little chip by chip, as they had to chip through the frost in order to be able to dig the grave. And old George was volunteered to be right in there because the young fellows didn't realize what the old George had vowed to do some 30 years before. And they took turns, hour after hour, until they got through the frost and they dug the grave. And they were all exhausted. Old George, being the senior man on the job, sent them all home, finished it up, and the young men never thought a thing of it. After the funeral, when it was time to lower the coffin into the grave, the undertaker discovered that the grave was dug a foot too deep for his straps and equipment to let the coffin to the bottom of the grave. And he had to pull the coffin back up, and then the undertaker had to put in another foot of soil in order to be able to lower the coffin down into the straps. Despite old George's vow to bury his estranged neighbor an extra foot deep, it just didn't happen. Let's turn to Psalm 94 and verse 1. In Psalm 94 and verse 1. O Lord our God, you to whom vengeance belongs, O God, you to whom vengeance belongs, shine forth. That's the Amplified version. You'll notice that it's repeated, and it's repeated for emphasis, that vengeance belongs to God. Similarly, in Romans 12:19, that concept, what the psalmist said and was repeated, avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place to the wrath of God, for it's written, vengeance belongs to me, I will recompense, says the Lord. That's the American Standard Version. Now, this is, of course, in the context of loving your neighbor as yourself. Let's look at Leviticus 19 and verse 18. In Leviticus 19 and verse 18. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Eternal. God tells us consistently in the Bible that's his job. It's not our job to take vengeance on others. Not to bear the grudge, even for 30 years. Not to dig the grave the extra foot deep. What man's plans don't turn out. So lesson 11 is, let God take care of the vengeance. We've got enough to concern ourselves with our own lives. Let God take care of the vengeance. And then there's a non-German fellow in the group, but he was from about 3-4 miles away. He was a Dane. There was a Danish community that was right next to the German community. And his name was Ozzy. And Ozzy was quite a fellow. He trusted everyone because everyone was his friend. We all know people like that. He was a farmer, but he was a rather accident-prone person. He was an older fellow when I was a younger man. And I remember when it happened, he had lost various pieces of his fingers along the way. And there was one winter when it was very cold out, and the machine tractor has a spinning shaft coming out of it called a power takeoff. He was a dairy farmer, and he came out of the barn, and where his gloves were a little bit wet. And the spinning shaft has a safety shield on it. Well, he was going to step over that part of the tractor, and he put his hand down, and the safety shield would slide. That's what it's there for. But it caught, and it pulled his hand and his glove, and the glove all came off, but it twisted around the thumb and pulled his thumb out by the roots. And it was a very, they said you could hear the scream for a mile. I can well believe it. We were all very, very careful about power takeoffs after we heard what happened to Ozzy. But Ozzy, and various stories of all the various stumps, he never buttoned his coat or his zippers on his jackets or anything, because he couldn't. He wore hooded sweatshirts and jackets. He could never button them up. We never understood. He loved to go fishing. I have never to this day understood how he could put bait on a hook. But he loved to go fishing. But besides farming, he also sold farm equipment like barn cleaners and silo unloaders and milk pipelines. And his idea of selling, he was just friends with everybody. I mean, he was everybody's friend, as it were. He was just real enjoyable type fellow. And so when he heard my dad was building a new silo, and my dad says, I just can't afford a new automatic silo unloader. We're lucky to be able to get the money to build the silo. He says, oh, don't worry about it. He just brought one over. And he threw it on the ground and says, put it in. You'll pay me when you can afford it. Well, that created kind of an obligation, and so Dad put it in, and over the next couple of years, he got it paid off and worked well. He did the same thing with a barn cleaner. He came over and says, you need a barn cleaner. You need an automatic barn cleaner. Here, and he brought a trailer over and unloaded all the stuff and said, if you remodel your barn and put in the barn cleaner, you'll be happy with that. Oh, well, we were going to fix up the barn anyway, so Dad put in the barn cleaner. Same thing happened when we went to a grade A dairy and had the automated pipeline. There was Ozzy saying, here, you're going to need this anyway. You're just really going to have to put this in. Pay me when you get around to it. But he trusted everybody. He was just a very congenial fellow. He was a little over 90 years old when I was coming home from, go to church in one city about 60 miles away, which was the closest church, and it was kind of a triangle. Then I would drive to that was up in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Then I would drive about 60 miles to the Twin Cities, where they would have like a private potluck and a Bible study at some church member's home. And then I'd drive about 60 miles back to the farm. It's usually pretty late on Saturday night when I get home. And I'm coming home one night, and I've got tire trouble. Actually, I had a wheel problem. For some reason or another, I had lost a couple of lug nuts on one wheel. The vehicle was serviced, and I didn't know quite what was wrong, and I got out, and my flashlight battery wasn't working, and it's about midnight. And a car drives up behind me, and it's Ozzy. He's out at midnight. He's over 90. And he says, and I said, well, I'll probably be okay. I'll tighten up what I have, that these lug nuts are loose, and if I shift enough around and I can make up for the lost ones, and if I drive slow, I'll probably make it home. So he followed me home with his car. It was 3-4 miles away, so that you know, and put lights on it so that I could see what I'm doing and follow me home just to make sure I made it. I said, Ozzie, what are you doing out at after midnight on a Saturday night? And he goes, well, he was admitted that he was just coming home from visiting a lady friend. And he had kind of embarrassed that I had caught him out that night, but he could not, kind of sense of obligation there that he help out somebody, especially this young kid that needed a little help. But Ozzie wasn't everybody's best friend, but he was everybody's friend. And he was genuinely friendly to everybody, and he was generally well thought of. He was blessed with a happy disposition and a long life. The lesson 12 from Ozzie: to have friends, you must show yourself friendly. That's in Proverbs 18:24. A man who has friends must himself be friendly. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. In other words, there's some friends that are closer even than family members. But Ozzie was very friendly, and friendly to everyone. So what godly principles can we learn from our neighbors? From Big Eddie, we learned in Lesson 1 that a soft answer turns away wrath. Or Lesson 2, don't miss an opportunity to say nothing and contain our anger. Lessons from Big Eddie. Lesson 3 from Cliff, we learned to live your dreams, but we should place our hope and confidence in God. And Lesson 4 from Ralph, we should have a vision of the future. We should think big beyond ourselves. In our case, we must keep our eye on the prize, the family of God. Have a vision of the future. Lesson 5 from Walt, live simply and tend to your own affairs. No need to be a busybody in other people's lives. Just live simply. In Lesson 6 from Art, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Lesson 7 from Ed, diligently follow the law, all of the time. In Lesson 8 from Sam, avoid guile, preserve your good name. In Lesson 9, from Leo, be ready always for an answer of the hope that lies within you. In Lesson 10, from Ernie, all things are possible with God. In Lesson 11, from George, let God take care of the vengeance. In Lesson 12, from Ozzie, to have friends, you must show yourself friendly. So what kind of a neighbor are we? What will our legacy be 50 years from now, when some person, now young perhaps, recounts his or her experiences about us? In Proverbs 22:1, we've covered that one. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor rather than silver and gold. So let's learn from the wisdom of our neighbors, and let's be the kind of neighbor from whom others can gain wisdom. Let's guard our good name. Let's demonstrate the love of God by keeping His commandments to love Him and love our neighbors as ourselves.